From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, Flight 232 and Surviving Survival. But here's what's happening. Look, if you use contact lenses, you have got to hear this story. A student in Taiwan who kept a pair of disposable contact lenses in her eyes for 6 months has been left blinded after a microscopic bug ate her eyeballs. The tiny single-cell amoeba ate away at the undergraduate's sight because she simply did not take them out and clean the contacts once during that time. And according to a warning issued by doctors, the case was particularly severe because of this young person under pressure who did not take the time to carry out basic hygiene on her contact lenses. Be careful. In New York, two sets of body parts have been found in 2 days on Long Island. The most recent incident, a man found a severed arm on his front lawn. The arm appeared to belong to a female and was severed from a shoulder. A day earlier, two people walking through a park in the Bay Shore area spotted a partially dismembered body of a woman. Jeez. United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has appealed for a ceasefire between Israel and Palestinian militants in the Gaza Strip. He urged both sides to exercise restraint, saying the Middle East could not afford another full-blown war. Craig Hewlett, of course, is our expert on these issues. Let's check with him now. Craig, is it going to blow out of proportion, or is it going to get slowed?
Well, you know, I'm going to have to pretend to be hopeful that both sides will negotiate and both sides will back off. But, you know, Israel and Hamas, Fatah has now joined the fight. ISIS fighters, which, you know, I would actually describe them considerably different than the way the media describes this Islamic Jihad movement. But the truth is, the West has created now a movement that I hated to predict 12 years ago in the Hydra that I wrote, but we've created an international guerrilla warfare movement against Israel and America and anything Western-oriented in the region. And yet at the same time, we refuse to admit our part in creating this enemy. Mm-hmm. We give $60 billion a year to the Saudis. We give $30, $60 billion to the Israeli state. How can these things not explode, and how can they not spill over into all the other nation states? My prediction is going to get a lot worse before it gets better.
I was going to say that, too. Do we have the makings, with everything that's happening around this planet right now, Craig, of another world war?
I think Paul Craig Roberts just did an interview with Voice of Russia, and he pretty much pointed out that we already are at war with Russia. We've already accelerated the war. In the region, the West was behind the overthrow of the Ukrainian government. And Islam runs from the Balkan states through Morocco all the way to Afghanistan and Indonesia. We're talking about a huge number of people. And the West is funding both sides. The Saudis are always playing both sides.
Sure.
I look at it still the way a French diplomat years ago once put it. Things will get settled in Israel and Palestine and the Middle East when God is dead.
And that, my friend, may take a long time.
Long time.
Craig Hewlett, his book, The Hydra of Carnage. The world's authority on Yellowstone's supervolcano, that's the caldera, says it's more than twice as big as scientists once thought. And does this mean it's more likely to blow up soon? Well, Penny Preston found that Dr. Robert Smith at his home, that's a writer, for a special television station out in the Billings, Montana area. He says, look, it's big. It erupts every 600,000 years. It may be overdue, but there are no signs that it looks like it's going to erupt. Thank God, because if it does, it could be devastating. Coastal flooding along the densely populated eastern seaboard of the United States has surged in recent years, as the water continues to reach flood levels all over the place. And many of the cold weather outbreaks this past winter were attributed to something called the polar vortex. This is where a flow pattern establishes in the upper atmosphere, and it draws cold Arctic air down across the Canadian prairies and down into the American Midwest and the Great Lakes region, and that is what happened. But now, the summertime version of the polar vortex is about to arrive next week, bringing cold air to the Great Lakes and much of the central North American area. Let's check in with the meteorologist, Scott Stevens. It's a little early for this, Scott, isn't it?
It is a little bit early, George, and I just posted an article up on my website, weatherwars.info, where I compare what was happening with the jet stream early July last year to this year, and they are surprisingly similar in shape, with the ridge out west and the trough in the east with the cool air draining out of Canada. What is different is the intensity. The depth of the low, the depth of the cold is much, much greater than last year, but the flow pattern, as it was last year, is again the same. And as we've said, this is the middle of summer.
Yeah.
This is the middle. And so this should not be happening if we were to be looking at normal climatological conditions. So this is very, very out of place.
And what's this going to do with the hurricane season, Scott? Anything?
You know, we could even look at a hurricane in the western Pacific as being a partial trigger for what is happening with this. There's a large hurricane rolling across Japan presently, and that energy is going to get injected into the North Pacific, and that may assist in kinking and either deepening this cold polar vortex coming or weakening a little bit, but it looks like it would have the effect of deepening it somewhat. Now, if this pattern stays in place, that would keep the easterlies coming off the tropics, which would feed those Antilles storms across the Caribbean into the Gulf. If this is in place, then we may see a later full-on start to the hurricane season, Arthur, all aside.
All right, Scott, thanks so much. A lot of people see orbs, but what they might be seeing might be called ball lightning, an unexplained atmospheric electrical phenomenon. The term refers to reports of luminous, spherical objects which vary in diameter, some from pea-sized to several meters. It is usually associated with thunderstorms, but lasts considerably longer than the split-second flash of a lightning bolt. It could kill you if it hits you. Up next, we'll be talking with an expert on ball lightning on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Now, until the 1960s, most scientists argued that ball lightning was not a real phenomenon, despite numerous sightings throughout the world. Laboratory experiments can produce effects that are virtually similar to reports of ball lightning, but whether these are related to the natural phenomenon remains unclear. Robert Golka is a research scientist who's been working on ball lightning since 1967. His research has led him to discover the components that inhibit the manufacturing of ball lightning. Robert continues his research. One day he hopes to be able to make ball lightning a reality, and he's here to explain this very bizarre phenomenon. Robert, always a pleasure. How are you?
Just fine.
Okay, so let's talk about ball lightning. I'm convinced that a lot of people who see these so-called orbs flying around, that it's probably ball lightning. But give us your definition, Robert, on just what you think it is.
Well, basically, it's a discharge when lightning strikes the ground that somehow it rolls up and becomes a stable structure of ionized particles and can last up to a minute and in various sizes and various colors. But the amazing thing is that it floats around, it can go against the wind, and there's no explanation for that in plasma physics. I've been around plasma physics for 35 years, and I keep up with what's being studied and the tokamaks and the fusion experiments. And at first I thought that ball lightning might be, if we could recreate it under controlled conditions in the laboratory, it might be a confinement, something that would hold high temperatures, kind of like a furnace without walls. And that was a good idea, but I never could find anything that would substantiate a proof of this. I had no idea how it would even work. And I talked to a few plasma physicists that were tokamak experts briefly, and they were talking using huge magnets to confine plasma and hold it at high temperatures. And the problem with plasma is that the hotter you get it, the more it wants to fly apart and repel it. The particles want to repel each other. It's just kind of more, the more energy you put into it and get it hotter, the more it tends to want to spread out and dissipate. So you got some real problems there. Somehow ball lightning doesn't do that. Now, what is the mechanism? It would be valuable to anybody in plasma physics to understand this, if there's an application for fusion or high temperature confinement. So that's my main interest, but I still think it goes beyond that. Now I have some ideas that maybe there's some other mechanism where this ball gets its energy. Maybe it isn't. I can't understand how a lightning discharge would keep something going for a minute. Usually a lightning discharge is,
it's a flash,
is over in, you know, a few seconds or so.
Right. That's
I've made things
point.
That look like ball lightning for last for maybe a 30th of a second, but that's, and a lot of other people have done that too and been fooled by it. But it's a real challenge.
Now it's small. It could look like a basketball. It could look like the size of a pea. And when you said it kind of floats with the environment, I mean, could it float in the wind like a balloon does?
Well, it seems sometimes that people have seen this coming towards their home, and the wind was blowing it away from them, but it still would progress, and sometimes it would enter through an open window or go through a screen or even a glass window.
Huh.
So it doesn't seem to be influenced by the air movement. Kind of like some things... in the UFO field,
yeah.
You know, they go and they don't make any noise. I don't rule any of this stuff out because it's all contributory to a theory, if you can make a theory out of this. So it seems to disobey some of the laws of nature and thermal movement. If you have a discharge or a flame, I mean, flame kind of goes up. The heat rises and makes the flame pointed at the upper end, so... Ball lightning doesn't seem to obey those laws.
How prevalent
is it?
How prevalent is it, Robert? During a thunderstorm, are we guaranteed to get ball lightning or a heat lightning? Will it happen then?
It's very rare. Really, lucky if 3 or 4% of the world's population has seen it. I have never seen it in nature, but I have talked to lots of people that have seen it. If you look at my just put my name on Google, Robert K. Golker, and you'll find a whole bunch of experiments and some documentation of people who have seen it and interviews with people who have seen it. And it's kind of scary to the person that sees it for the first time.
If it hits hits you, though, could it kill you? Could it hurt you?
It's possible. People have been burned by these things. Lots of time, it doesn't do much. Might just burn you a little bit. My cousin, back in 94, before they didn't even know I was into ball lightning research, I don't see him that often, but they encountered it coming back from a friend's house, walking on the street during a very fierce lightning storm that was coming in, and the girl said that she might have stepped on it, but she wasn't sure, but these balls were dancing across the road, and they were probably 3 or 4 inches in diameter, and they were near a big... water storage tanks, and that was in Stoughton, Massachusetts. So that's on the website if you want to see that interview. And another fellow that contacted me said he saw it in the power station out in Fairbury, Nebraska back in 1950. He was an engineer that was rebuilding a turbine, and he's still alive, and he describes it very clearly. That's also
your YouTube, right?
YouTube, yeah.
Robert,
so you can see these people that tell these stories. I mean, they're very legitimate, and there's no reason people would make up stories like that that I know of. Sometimes people like a little publicity, but I screen these things very carefully and ask a lot of questions.
You have said in the past that they can enter planes. How does that happen?
That's a good question. The old World War II fighter planes, some of them dragged an antenna behind them, and the ball would come up on that antenna and roll into the back of the plane.
My God.
Other passenger planes have just had it come in from the from nose through the radar dome and then somehow gets into the pilot's compartment and then goes through the door, under the door, and rolls down the passenger column and scares the life out of the passengers.
Oh, my gosh.
And these balls are usually about the same size, maybe basketball size, 15, 14 inches in diameter, of different colors. Maybe sometimes it hisses a little bit. But the airline industry has been told to their employees to suppress this, don't talk about it, and don't talk about it to reporters and things like that. But I've got a number of cases that have been seen ball lightning on the airplane, and I don't know the mechanism. You're basically in a shielded environment, a Faraday cage, and usually lightning, when you're inside a cage, lightning will not mm-hmm. bother you.
Some people have reported that they're in their bedroom, and all of a sudden, the room illuminates. Now, some have said, was there a UFO outside, and it, you know, it shined a light inside of my room? I don't know. But is it possible what they might have seen was a burst of ball lightning in their room?
Well, I don't know. That's a tough question to answer. But I do know that these UFO stories sometimes talk about these little plasmoids that float around and spy on them or look at them. Who knows? I mean, if these are UFOs or what they claim they are, they got intelligences and technologies that we haven't even dreamed of. So possibly they maybe understand the structure of ball lightning and how to create it and use it as some kind of a surveillance device.
Submarines during World War II, they had ball plasma inside the subs, didn't they?
That's correct. Usually when they're maneuvering at a docking area and backing up, they have these long control rods that are kind of like brakes on old vehicles, the handbrake type thing that they squeeze a handle and move it back and forth. And these contactor controls would operate the engines. And remember, a submarine is basically a DC device that has the propulsion system is no more than, say, 480 volts, but a lot of amperage behind it. And quite common, I've talked to a lot of veterans, sub-veterans, that have seen the ball form in the maneuvering room where they control the switches to operate the submarine and then passed into the first engine room, then into the second engine room. These are all isolated compartments. Usually the doors are open and hit the back wall of the second engine room. And it would be about the size of a Big Mac and always about the same size, always kind of usually a reddish color. And I've performed experiments on it, which is also on the Internet, on YouTube. And you can see I tried to short circuit the first generator and made these discharges. But they were just sparks. They weren't any balls. They were just like welding sparks, which fly all over the place. But they didn't behave at all like ball lightning. And I spent a whole week doing that out in Michigan. So it's a tricky phenomena. It's just you got to get electrical conditions exactly right. And that's what I'm kind of working on now, as to how to really narrow these things down. And then once you get resonances and things in the circuitry, maybe you'll see something. I don't know.
How did you
have to do this work.
How did you even start to investigate this, Robert?
Well, it's a funny thing. It started with a bet with a radio station engineer that he said ball lightning had been discovered and made in a laboratory, and I said, no, I didn't think so. This was back in 66, 67. Uh-huh. And I said, where'd you hear about this? And he said, I read it somewhere in some magazine. I said, think back, and I'll come back in a week or two. Well, I came back in a week or so, and he said, yeah, it was in QST magazine. And he didn't tell me it was in 1920. So
yeah.
I went up to MIT's engineering library and under the big dome there, and I spent about 3 weeks going through every page of QST magazine, and this started in 1911, and I found it in December.
You did
of
find
1920.
It.
Here's the story, but this man had produced it, and it was a letter to the editor. So,
huh.
Now in 1920, people that had ham radio spark gap sets. It was just strictly dot dash spark gap type communication at that time. World War One came around, and suddenly these guys were not allowed to broadcast. So they made little Tesla coils and showed things at county fairs. And this fella had this coil set up on the fourth floor of this building in Chattanooga, and that's, he said, a few times he was pushing the key down, making sparks, and this ball formed off the top of the coil one time, another time off the steam pipe. And so talk about long-winded, long-time communications. I started calling everybody in 1967 with the name Benjamin Painter, and any painter found after a few weeks, nobody knew about this. And then I started calling companies, and by God, this fella that he owned a company that did Teflon coating on frying pans.
Hold on for a second, Robert. We're going to talk more, and we'll take some calls next. Welcome back. Robert Golka with us as we talk about ball lightning. Robert, do you see any special application if we could harness ball lightning? Could we use it for anything?
It may have application in nuclear fusion, but I have my doubts about that. Can I finish the story that I started before that?
Talking about the submarines, weren't we?
No, we're talking about this fellow in Chattanooga, Tennessee, that made ball lightning in 1920s. So he was experimenting with basically a spark gap transmitter. Anyway, he wrote an article to the editor of QST magazine and asked if anybody had seen that. Now, I found that magazine and at MIT in 1967, and I started calling down to Chattanooga, and after a long period, I did get in contact. He said, I called and talked to him, and he said, I was the guy that did that, and that was almost 50 years earlier. So I said, hold on, I'm going to fly down and see an interview. And so I got all the information how he built this coil, and that's what got me started in ball lightning. And it's been a long road since then. But it's amazing he was still alive. He did die in the 70s, but I thought that was an amazing find to go back almost 50 years for somebody who had done this effect.
Well, how come it hasn't been replicated?
Well, we don't know. I mean, I spent about 2.5 years replicating his experiment. I didn't really consider the building having enough plot in it, but I've come back to that work after 35 years, and I've taken into account the building, the metal steel building that he worked in, and I found out how certain the plumbing and thing can resonate. So I've made a model of that building. It's a 200-foot, 16-story building, and I've replicated that with a 6-foot model and got it to resonate. So I'm on the trail. There's still more to do, so I won't go into all the detail, but that was a lucky find, and then it's amazing. I saved all the architectural prints of the building and replicated exactly the way the thing was constructed with the steam piping and all the plumbing. So that's the thing that got me interested, and I think that's going to lead to something.
What is Project Tesla, Robert?
Project Tesla was a replication of Nikola Tesla's 1899 50-foot diameter coil that he built, a Tesla coil for making high voltage. Nobody up until the mid-70s had ever recreated anything that size. And I first built it on the Bonneville salt flats, thinking the ground conductivity of the salt would be very helpful. But I found out that wasn't too important. And then I was able to lease some property from the Air Force, big 44,000 square foot hangar for $1 a year. And I had that for 8 years.
That's not a bad deal.
There are ways to get things done if you get resourceful and willing to do experiments in the wilderness.
Let's take some phone calls for you. William is in Bloomington, Illinois, on the wild card line. William, let's get us started here.
Well, George, I'm glad you're talking about this topic because I am an eyewitness. Back in the late 50s, my aunt ran a restaurant, and we were getting out of our car, and it was one of those gray, overcast days. And just as we were getting out of this car, we seen this ball come down from the sky, make a turn, go across the parking lot, and hit this tree and went and split this tree in half and then went right back up into the sky. And it scared the living heck out of me. I know that. I mean, it was something that you just couldn't explain. But we went inside the restaurant, and all the people inside were off from the tables. They were, you know, I mean, it really startled everybody, really.
Oh,
but it was crazy. Let's put it that way.
Well, Robert, why wouldn't it dissipate after it blasted the tree?
Well, I don't know. But what color was it and how big was it?
Well, it's been many years ago. I know it wasn't as big as a basketball, but it was a little bit larger than a softball. So I guess it's in between those two. But we know it traveled about 5 feet off the ground because when it hit the tree, the hole or where it split just like a like a wishbone, and that was about the height of where it hit the tree. That I remember very well.
That must have had a lot of energy, and it was a kind of a bright white, or was it more of a red, or what kind of color?
I think it was more of a, it was more white than anything else. I mean, it wasn't blue,
right,
pink, or green.
If you can remember for sure, that would probably be something with a lot of high energy packed into it. But that's quite a sighting. I hope some people have some recent sightings of this.
I tell people about it, and they don't believe me, but I'll tell you what, I'm a believer, and I'm glad you're on this topic because it verifies what I saw. I know that for a fact.
Absolutely. Tell me about the color again.
I think
again.
You saw the real thing.
The color.
And
why
a lot of people should look into these things just for informational sake, but I'm glad you believe and saw it and talk to people and convince them this is a real phenomenon.
Why is the color so important, Robert?
Why? Because sometimes I get information like he said it was kind of a whitish color, and that tells me when it blew the tree apart that generally when you have something that plasma that's under high, it's stored in a lot of energy, it gets kind of white colored, kind of like a discharge instead of like a flame, you know what I'm saying? It's basically stores a lot of particle energy that are moving very fast and the colors change. So I always try to pick up information like that.
Sure.
So later on I can apply it to a theory.
Let's go east of the Rockies. David's with us in San Antonio, Texas. Hi, David.
Hey, guys. Hey, I've actually seen both. It was probably right after Hail Bop, so that would have been, what, 97, somewhere in that ballpark.
Good.
I was on my second-story balcony, kind of like an idiot, standing outside in the thunderstorm. And I don't remember lightning hitting, traditional lightning, and then hitting and then thunder, but there was the kind of electrical storm where you just see the bright lights, and you just don't really hear the lightning. You just see the sporadic flashes of light. And the one I saw didn't come down out of the sky like that last caller. Mine actually slowly manifested in the parking lot and then blew around like a balloon and bounced off the garage door and then blew right up at me and then evaporated before it hit me. And it was about the size of a large, like a beach ball, and it was white. And I think it was a natural phenomenon. I sat there just kind of freaked out for a little bit trying to figure out what I saw. And I went on the internet and did some research and obviously found ball lightning, and somebody had actually done a little reproduction video of it, you know, in a little 30-second film of exactly what I saw. And I thought, well, that was weird. Anyway, didn't think anything of it till probably 10, 12 years later. I used to ride my mountain bike at 1 or 2 in the morning just to get out and, you know, be by myself and go out in the woods and go see animals and whatnot. And this is why I think the phenomenon of the ball lightning is maybe a natural phenomenon, but the orbs, I think there's something more to the orbs as far as an intellectual aspect to it, because I was facing down trail. I was kind of on a packed trail. I was on my mountain bike, and obviously you're alert, but you're not really scared, but you're kind of alert of what's going on. I just heard this loud, like two clangs, like two like, I don't know, loud drums was the only way I could explain it. And when I turned around during that split second, the sound that I heard was a large male deer jumping over a fence, and his two front feet were hitting the concrete of the road. And then his other two feet hit, and right behind the deer, there were two orbs the size of a grapefruit, or maybe a little bit bigger than a grapefruit, swirling together, like parallel to each other, and they were more of a reddish orange. They were totally, and I got the impression the orbs were taunting the deer. It was either coincidence that they were right behind the deer scaring it out of that field, or it wasn't coincidence. So I was sitting there thinking, first of all, what the hell was that all about? But the orbs were in conscious control. They were harassing the deer.
Well, as you know, there are no coincidences, and we really are dealing with a different thing. I think some orbs have been confused for ball lightning and vice versa. The orbs, you know, I've heard all kinds of stories, Robert, that they're souls from the dearly departed to mini UFOs, who knows what. But have you looked at any relationship between the ball lightning and the UFOs?
I think there's a tie in there, but I don't get into that because I can't reproduce it, but I think that those orbs he talked about were taunting, and the deer tells me that this probably was some UFO-related phenomena.
Yeah,
because lightning doesn't just, you know, it might look like it's chasing something, but two of them together, that's unusual. He might have saw this old video 10 or 15 years ago where I'd made ball lightning and what looked like ball lightning and with a heavy submarine battery discharge on the surface of water. So I've done a lot of work in this area, but again, I really think that there's possibly this ball lightning could be getting some energy from another dimension. I hate to say that.
Oh,
but,
really? Tell me more about that.
I feel that there's a lot more to this than it meets the eye, so to speak. And,
so, like, it may be intelligently directed from another dimension?
No, I just think it's some kind of dimension. To, you know, what powers ghosts? What makes these things move and poltergeist and thrown? So I think that the ball lightning somehow can gets energy from that level of whatever it is. I don't know. We don't have enough information to really put a good theory together. But maybe, you know, when I can manufacture this stuff repeatedly in the laboratory, then we'll have a tool to look into this business of where the energy comes from, whether it's stored energy or whether it comes from another dimension.
Have you ever been hurt doing this?
It makes life interesting.
Have you ever been hurt doing this?
No. I'm very careful working with high voltage and high current.
Let's go to Tom in Detroit, Michigan. Tom, you're up with us. Go ahead.
Okay, I got three quick questions. First off, I read that Nikola Tesla used to come out before audiences and actually appear to hold ball lightning, you know, inches above his hand. And also, last summer, I was with some friends, and we saw these, like, little orbs miles away, way up in the sky, like in a line of these orange dots. And I've seen them on YouTube also. And when the Challenger that exploded coming back to Earth in the atmosphere, on YouTube, they got video from inside the cockpit where, you know, the astronauts are wondering, what are these flashes of light? And it was coming through the window, and I read that that was plasma that was entering into the cabin as it was entering, and it eventually, you know, destroyed the cockpit. And I wonder if that had any relationship to ball lightning. So you got three there, Tesla.
Okay, I'll answer
this guy.
Yeah, I don't think the ball lightning, that's ball lightning that was happening in outer space there with the astronauts. Tesla made sparks come out of his hands. I studied him I have all his notes and stuff that he wrote back in 1899, and he never made ball lightning in his hands. He claimed he could make it, but after 8 years or 9 years out in Utah, experimenting with this big coil, I don't think he did it. And he was a showman. He liked to make sparks come off his fingers.
He was a showman. That's
true. You can do that. And he liked this. He liked the publicity, and he made some good inventions. But I don't think he was able to produce ball lightning on command. But interesting guy. He certainly built the big coil, gave us AC electrical power distribution, which was far better than DC, which is what Edison was promoting.
Is mainstream science, Robert, doing anything to investigate ball lightning?
Very little.
Why is that?
People don't want, in government people, academia don't want to spend money in unknown things. It could be detrimental to their reputation and chances to get recognition.
When we get reports,
I can live with that. But people at universities have a lot of trouble looking into ball lightning. They just won't get the funding. And you know, the Navy at one time in 1951 was very interested in what was happening on these submarines with these fireballs and ball lightning running down the engine rooms. And they tried a few attempts to understand it, but got nowhere. I mean, it's something you have to spend a lot of time with, and I'm glad I put this time in, because every year I worked on it, I'd be learning something new and exciting about what is happening. I would rather do this kind of work than be a millionaire, to be honest with you. I mean, to me, it's a daily excitement.
Well, good,
you know,
for you.
You work at.
When we hear reports that houses have been hit by lightning and they burn to the ground, is it possible that they got hit by a huge ball lightning? Or it doesn't have to be that big.
I can't answer that. That's something I can't.
You scientists.
They can cause fires sometimes, I've heard, but not enough of those cases to really draw conclusions. Yeah.
How do they go through glass?
Basically, it's probably like a capacitive action where you charge up one side of the glass and the other side gets charged oppositely. And a few people have done experiments. A Japanese fellow there, he thought he transmitted a plasma through a piece of ordinary window glass, but it's not easy to do. And but the fact that and that was just electric charges or just a random discharge, not a ball, but somehow ball lightning effortlessly goes through it without breaking the glass. It's amazing how it goes through a screen, which could be grounded and not melt the thin wires of the screening. It's another amazing thing. So sometimes it has heat, sometimes it doesn't distribute the heat. It just contains it. That's a good trick if you can do that.
Let's go to Oklahoma City. Charlie is with us. Charlie, you're on the air.
Yes. I've seen ball lightning and I've seen St. Elmo's fire artificially reproduced. But I have a question afterward.
All right.
I saw on occasion in Houston one time the telephone lineman. You know the shovel handle knife switch that's at the bottom of the pole?
Right. I know what those are.
Okay.
Thing has been seen running down power lines quite a bit, but go ahead.
Right. Sure. The worker who was shutting the knife switch, you know, with the shovel handle at the end of the bottom of the pole, when he closed it, I could see St. Elmo's fire just illuminate the immediate sky around the top of the telephone pole. It was translucent. It looked just like fire. And I've tried like the Dickens to get a lineman to find some lineman who's been working on the line to do this.
To verify this, yeah.
Well, they don't like to play with that stuff on those circuits because you usually get an arc when you close one of those switches. It's unusual if you make a plasma glow or a St. Elmo's fire. St. Elmo's fire is vastly different than ball lightning, but I've heard of big glows following power lines. There's something on YouTube that shows a power line with this huge cloud of ionized gases going down the line, and it's not destroying the transformer or anything on the line. So that could be a variation of controlled ionization that we know very little about, but it was not ball lightning. But there's some strange things that happen on power lines that the power industry doesn't like to really talk about, but they do happen. And I can't chase all these variations in animals, these other animals, so to speak, but I stick pretty much with ball lightning where it's confined, it breaks off and floats across a room, or comes into a house, or goes upstairs, or falls a power line after a lightning strike. So I kind of confine my research to that area, and I'm always looking for recent case histories of sightings of ball lightning, because sometimes this gives me information on the mechanisms of its creation.
Well, good job for you, Robert. And if you want more information on Robert Golka, it's Robert K. Golka, G-O-L-K-I, and he's got a lot of information at YouTube, okay? We shall be back in a moment with a special program. The first hour, we're talking about Flight 232, a story of disaster and survival.